La antorcha olímpica se ha transformado en una lección de derechos humanos para la Unión Americana. Beatriz Salas amplía la información.
Decidir sobre quiénes serán los portadores de la antorcha en la ceremonia inaugural de los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno en Pekín es la responsabilidad de China, y Estados Unidos no está en posición de hacer comentarios despectivos. Así respondió Pekín a la reciente interferencia de Washington, quien aseveró que la elección de China del atleta de la etnia Uyghur, Denijir Jilamujian, para llevar la antorcha olímpica es un esfuerzo de Pekín para distraer la atención del llamado genocidio en la región de Xinjiang.
Los llamados comentarios de genocidio de Estados Unidos son la gran mentira del siglo y exponen su intento de politizar los Juegos Olímpicos de invierno y su siniestra intención de utilizar el tema relacionado con Xinjiang para difamar a China.
China asimismo acusó a Estados Unidos de mentir de manera descarada sobre las minorías étnicas, mientras olvida sistemáticamente discriminaciones en su propio suelo.
Estados Unidos llevó a cabo un genocidio contra los nativos americanos en el pasado y ha discriminado sistemáticamente a las minorías raciales a largo plazo. La población de nativos americanos se ha desplomado de 5 millones a finales del siglo XV a unos 250 mil a principios del siglo XX, reduciéndose a una vigésima parte. ¿Qué es el genocidio? Las políticas que Estados Unidos ha impuesto a los nativos americanos son un verdadero genocidio.
Zhao, además de criticar la discriminación racial contra los africanos y asiáticos en Estados Unidos, dijo que elegir a un atleta de la etnia Uyghur muestra que la política de China de promover los deportes de invierno y mejorar la salud de las personas está beneficiando a individuos de todos los grupos étnicos y prueba que no existe discriminación.
Lo que Estados Unidos debería estar haciendo es revisar cuidadosamente sus propios crímenes históricos contra los nativos americanos y tomar medidas concretas para reducir la discriminación racial contra estas personas y otras minorías raciales, como los africanos y asiáticos.
China, en reiteradas ocasiones, ha instado a Estados Unidos a dejar de usar los asuntos vinculados con Xinjiang para difundir mentiras, interferir en los asuntos internos de China o intentar detener el desarrollo del país. Advierte que, de lo contrario, Pekín dará una respuesta más contundente a la luz del desarrollo de la situación. Beatriz Salas con información de Niloufar Shakuri, Hispan TV Noticias.
Migrantes de todos los rincones del mundo duermen bajo su mismo cielo estrellado. Me los encuentro en las calles, en los cines, en los supermercados, y el olor de sus comidas me embriaga de placer. Todos ellos son mis vecinos.
Y yo aquí vivo, bajo sus leyes domésticas, pago impuestos y mis manos producen la riqueza nacional.
Soy parte de esa comunidad que vive, trabaja y sueña con una mañana mejor para nuestras familias.
Casi todos migrantes como yo, casi todos soñadores como yo.
Trabajemos pues en la construcción de otra nación que nos haga dignos.
Seamos los arquitectos de nuestro sueño colectivo.
Esta radio no tiene comerciales porque tú nos apoyas. Si ya has hecho una aportación económica, te damos las gracias. Si no, hazlo ahora en kpfk.org o llama al 818-985-5735.
Así llegamos al final de esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro más profundo agradecimiento a todos los medios y personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Told me, you know, we'll give you a day, we'll give you a week, however long it takes for you to accept our help to be healed and to become a child of God and denounce being gay.
Honoring the memory of Dr. Anonymous, coming up on the Rainbow Minute.
I got three quarters of the way through several times and was like, well, I have no idea how this would end, so I have to start over. But one thing I know is I can't end a story without hope.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Nicaragua's NGO Purge targets its oldest queer group. Gay Taiwanese movie sings out a universal love song and upending the artistic process with Amanda Kayback. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Joe Bainline.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 28, 2021. The government of Nicaragua is aiming to shut down the country's oldest LGBTQ advocacy group. The Interior Ministry has asked the National Assembly to annul the legal nonprofit status of Fundacion Xaquiquetzal and 14 other non-governmental organizations. President.
So comes now the August 3rd, 2023 edition of Bathrobe's Piers Broadsides. We've been having transmitter problems for about a week now almost, maybe not quite that, which means, transmitter isn't the word, it's our website, the Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom Huff website. It can be accessed in part, but some of the audio sections are not available, and that has to do with our webmaster in Texas, and I'm not sure what his problem is, but I'm told by his local rep that it's being worked on, although it's awfully slow. It's never been this slow, and I apologize to all listeners, because what that means is you can't access the latest shows through the Huff website. You can listen to them directly through freakradio.org, and that's how I'm going to be playing this particular show, which is simply going to be a repetition of the Sunday, July 30th show, because that show did get out on the net. We aren't, of course, broadcasting anymore, haven't for several years, but we usually go out on the net, and then also at the same time on the archive, or even sometimes a little before on the archive, on the Huff website archive. But today, if you're listening to this on August 3rd, this is going to be it. It's going to go out on the net, and that's all, until such time as it gets archived, which will be happening whenever the website gets fixed. So that's really all I've got to tell you. This is sort of an introduction to a show that I put in the can some days ago. I guess I'll mention that Cooper and Russell, who had their camp destroyed along with that of others up at the end of Golf Club Drive after they'd fled the Highway 9 area, although I'm not quite exactly sure about that, but a number of people with them certainly were in the Highway 9 area, driven away from there, and then driven away from Golf Club Drive, and then pursued as well. That we heard in an interview, which I may be playing on Sunday, hopefully, and I have no idea if that hope is justified. By Sunday, there will be web access. We'll be able to put it on the archives as well as play it again, and play it in the usual fashion that you're hearing it today, if you're listening to it on August 3rd, on the net, directly on Netcast. Anyway, they're at liberty, as far as I know, at the moment, and angry at the seizure of all their property and possessions. And if you have any reports, please, of sweeps that have happened in the last week, starting at the end of July, I'd like to hear about them. What was taken, who did them, what was said during them, where they happened, and what folks have to say about them. And you can give me a call on the HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom line, which is still available. It's a landline, unfortunately. You can't text, but you can leave a message usually, relatively one- or two-minute message at most. But I will call you back if you can give me a callback number, or if you have an email, leave that, or a contact point, leave that. And, well, it's, yeah. So that's my intro. We're going to go into the show now and enjoy it. And here it is. And coming up next on the archives, it's the July 30th, 2023 edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides, strung together with masking tape and sealing wax, so to speak. Some interviews, a lengthy replay of an interview with Sarah Leonard. For those who don't follow M.H. Can, there's a lot of talk in the mainstream media about dealing with folks who are outside as mental health problems or drug substance abuse problems rather than housing problems, which really is what the reality is, though these other things, of course, begin to enter into it. The more abuse that folks suffer outside, and the longer they go without sort of the basic necessities, particularly as they get older. And here's another apology in advance for problems with the sound that I'm noticing have been coming up both in past netcasts and even looking back on this one as I even start. So I'm hoping we can get beyond it, but you may have to turn up the volume at times. You may have to skip ahead at times. You may have to, quit listening in frustration at times. We're going to go ahead anyway and see what I can do with the equipment that I've got. So realizing that much of my audience may know what MH Can is, some don't. That's Mental Health Clients Action Network, originally a patients group that came together to address psychiatric abuse and the need for support among folks with psychiatric experiences that usually get them directed to psych wards or psychiatrists or into medications and so forth. HUF, as probably has been explained in past shows, has, it's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the organization I work with, has had a particular interest in expanding the power and reach of MHCAN, which is a small group affecting at a time only, well, they're supposed to let in only 50 people a day because of, I should say, suffocating restrictions, in my view, put on them by the city in collusion with the police force and probably a nearby property owner, it's been suggested, who wants to take over their property, and also neighbors who are don't want folks with psychiatric conditions and diagnoses or poor people you know, hanging out in their neighborhood. This used to be out on Soquel Avenue. It still is, MH Can. But they used to provide, I think they still do provide meals of a modest sort. They were doing food giveaways. I don't know if they're still doing that. But actually, you'll hear Sarah Leonard, the director of MH Can, talk about the services. She describes them. I can't vouch for the accuracy of what she's saying, nor do I suggest it is not accurate. Although my most recent interaction with MH Can has been a rough one. A member of Huff came to an individual who felt he'd been mistreated by MH Can because he'd been excluded for a year from their services. And we had a kind of a discussion. Sarah Leonard, to her credit, along with the workers, came, and her co-workers, her co-staff. And there was some exchange. I don't know. It was a very satisfactory outcome. But I thought that this case could interview what little I heard of it. I didn't hear the whole thing. But Sarah can be very eloquent. I may be interrupting with some discussion of my own, though. I haven't been to the MH Can HQ out there along. It's not exactly on Soquel Avenue. I think it's just off of Soquel. You look it up under MH Can, MHCAN, if you want to get more information, or, you know, go on over there and see for yourself how things are going. But there's a lot of positive reports I've gotten, and I've been concerned, as I said, of the city's restrictions. So anyway, you'll be hearing some of that. You'll be hearing some interviews with Cooper D'Angelo, who called into my phone at various times in the last week trying to report what was going on out there, as the police first threatened and then actually took away survival gear, tents, and drove people without giving them decent places to go, at least in the estimation of the people who were involved there. At least that was Cooper's perspective. You'll get to hear that. We've got some other interviews, too, of a different sort, often involving police misconduct, sort of wandering down Pacific Avenue and getting, actually, I think it was more food, not bombs. But, well, stay tuned, and you'll hear actually more of the usual, which is the stuff I usually put on this show. And today is going to be no exception.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin with the first of three phone calls from Cooper D'Angelo. This one was on the 24th of July, last week. I guess it was almost a week ago now. And she talks about hard times or worrisome times, although she keeps in good spirits up in her campsite of, I don't know where we'd call it. I guess it's the Lower Meadow or the Poganip or above the tracks. Anyway, it's somewhere up there at the end of Golf Club Road, Golf Club Drive. Okay, well, it's about 7:20 on the 24th of July, and I'm on the line with Cooper D'Angelo. Hello, Cooper.
Hi, Robert.
And you say you've got some updates on you and the police and life outside.
Right. And, they moved people out of Neary Lagoon, and a lot of people came to the safety of this Poconip area. And we have a good, safe camp here with a kitchen and everything. And 7 days ago, so we'd only been here a little while, 7 days ago, the police came, 8 cops came. They ticketed every single person here with these bogus closed area tickets and a court date. And the last time I dealt with one of the police, he said they're working for the judge. That the judge wants people in the courtroom. And another thing that the police have said is they're covered to lie through the Ellis Act passed by Obama. So all these bogus tickets, they said they're covered to lie and that we can go discuss it with the judge, which is human trafficking because the judge makes money on the bogus tickets or any ticket as long as you make it in the courtroom. And if you don't, then what the judge is doing is sending the cops to hunt people down. And again, human trafficking, so that the judge makes money on the people's bodies. So then, 5 days ago, they came with eviction notices saying that by the 25th, which is tomorrow, everybody needs to be gone from here. And they came up, then Jeremy Leonard, who is the human trafficker, he's the one that tries to get the people into those concentration camps. They're toxic. They have people are very, very sick and need rehab and need help. They have 60 people using 2 porta potties, 2 toilets up at the armory. You know, and it's a concentration camp. You lose your rights. People are being moved then or asked to be moved from their nice tents into a very small 5x5 cell type tent where even a tall person has to lay side to side. And those are in Leonard's camp over on Highway 9, another drug infested toxic camp.
You're talking about 1220. That's 1220 River. Go ahead.
Yes, yes, and they're trying to make our people go there. And they get money for every person that goes there. So, again, it's human trafficking where people are taken from where they want to be and shuffled into these concentration camps where they're making money on the people's body. That's human trafficking.
Now, so Cooper, let me interrupt you. Let me interrupt you for a moment. I know you've often said this, but I've never been able to get any documentation from other sources about where exactly and how much and what source supposedly this money comes from. How do you know this is actually? I mean, I think that they want to get more grants, and I think that, you know, the more people they can round up, the more likely they are to get more grants. But I'm not aware that they're actually getting a particular bounty for each person. But if you have any new information on that, I'm interested.
Yeah, I believe they're definitely making money. They're using the people with this federal relief money for the people, saying that they're housing all these people. And otherwise, they would have freedom camps. If they weren't making money on the people, there'd be no motive for them to move us.
We accept that they're probably...
capitalism is awry.
Yeah, except
they're making money off people suffering.
Right.
And
I mean,
people working there have a job.
Cooper, I don't disagree. I don't disagree with you generally, but I think,
yeah,
you know, for skeptics who are listening, they want to know where are the documents that show they're getting money for each person who comes in. I mean, I understand your argument.
And I guess,
you know,
and you need to get, and I have a other thing about Monarch services, and they were wonderful. I was taken to jail over bogus tickets. And they take you to court on the third day because most people are addicted. That's why God only has me smoke weed. And I went in, and again, I'm telling the judge, I'm the one in handcuffs and shackles telling the judge that I'm here on bogus tickets that the cops said they're okay to lie, that they're covered to lie, they're working for the judge, and that the Ellis Act by Obama covered them to lie.
Now, when was the last time you were in court with a judge?
And that was the end of April, I believe. It may have been like May Day, right around there.
Do you remember what judge it was?
It was Payton, because it sounded like bacon.
And how do you spell that?
I think it's P-A-D-E-N.
Payton.
He gave me all kinds of false charges and false stay-away orders that are illegal for him to give off federal sidewalks and stuff. I didn't commit any crime on any of those places. So it's all these word games because they're trying to get slaves. And I have no criminal record at all. And they don't like that. They don't want anybody that is a runaway slave.
So
they
want
to make money.
So you still had, you went to court in April or in May, early May, and were you then, did you do a deal with them, or are you still facing trial?
Yeah, under duress, they made me plead to for not showing up for sentencing when I was illegally sentenced in 2016. I was assaulted by a cop, and the ticket he gave me was resisting arrest, and there was nothing arrestable or ticketable or anything. And they found the cop innocent and me guilty.
Name of the cop?
And the cop was D. Albert, and I was attacked. Mm. And there were 20 people who videoed it, and the court didn't allow any of that in as part of my defense. So the public defender's in on it, the DA's in on it, and the judges all to rake people into the jail and into the courtroom. And you know, you got to...
You're beginning to fade out there. Say that again.
You know, people are people. So I think we have some very sick judges right now.
So you have a date tomorrow where you have to be out of this area. The places they offered for you to go were these areas that you describe as concentration camps, 1220
yeah.
River. What kind of...
Right, where you move from, you know, we're like in a family setting, and we would move to a 5x5 tent in a drug-infested area. That's what they want you to do. And that's not okay because the housing under Boise versus Martin, they can't criminalize when they're not providing housing. But shelter has to suffice for all the homeless. They can't discriminate and just say only the drug addicted homeless can have housing. It has to be a teacher that's homeless. All the homeless students, there's nothing for anybody.
Now, what's the reaction been of co-tenants here, the community that around you? Has there been much discussion as to what to do about this?
Well, I mean, we're kind of at the end of the game because I think they're about to get busted. You can only do this kind of human trafficking with people so long before other states and other higher officials find out. And America may divorce California because they've taken federal money, bailout money, over and over and over, and the same people are used in the extortion racket in the court. And they're using tax money to do it.
So we
may see California alone to take care of themselves, and Mexico is going to do an incentive for their people to go home.
How many people is this?
Because America has been using, California has been using the Hispanics to fuel the prison.
Cooper, how many people in your community is this impacting tomorrow, would you estimate?
Oh, they probably wrote, what do you think, 30-something tickets the other day? Yeah. And we only have one person that left to the armory.
And so you have approximately 29 people who are continuing to live there and are likely to be around what tomorrow... Do they have a time tomorrow morning when they say they are supposedly coming to oust you?
Yeah, I don't know. They did on some form that I usually don't keep, but I don't know. I hope something halts them. Let's say that.
And if anybody now, you know, this probably won't be played until Thursday after you're all shoveled away. But if somebody wanted to come up there, where should they go to witness and document what's going on and be supportive?
Well, up Golf Club Drive.
Okay.
It's just all the way to the top of Golf Club Drive. And this property, which was originally in 1911 a golf course, it was entrusted to the city for family and recreation purposes only. And that's what we're doing. We're family and recreation purposes. So we're actually using the land. We are city residents as it is stated to be used. That's why no homes are built up here. That's why Homeless Garden Project can't get a farm up here. And I hope it turns back into a golf course someday. But right now, we're family and recreating, which is what this land is deemed to be.
Well, what's this for? The police, of course, are never really predictable. They do whatever they want. But I'm wondering, what's your, because you have, you know, a certain amount of experience, however, you know, hard it is to draw any conclusions from what's happened before. What do you think is going to happen tomorrow?
I don't know. I think the overturn happened in the Watsonville Family Court today because today is the Independence Day that Utah. Utah is the exception to the rule. They don't celebrate the 4th of July. They celebrate it on the 24th. The 4th of July, if the exception to the rule becomes the rule, then our new Independence Day will be today. And that there was an overturning court today, and news hits tomorrow morning like Christmas in July.
I'm sorry. What are you expecting will be overturned? I'm not clear on this.
Well, the police have been okayed to lie since Obama was president, and they've been lying about people left to make up crimes and investigating. The media blocked Israel.
You're fading out again.
Taken for all these crimes, the police were set up with a fake crime. And the police and the FBI and the judge, they all took the bait, hook, line, and sinker, and they all took hearsay. The coroner, CPS, all of them took hearsay. And a little special ed kid has been locked up, an innocent kid has been locked up for 8 years, and it was a hoax. And it was to see the natural behavior of the criminal system here in Santa Cruz in the media. And they're making a crime.
What kid are you talking about, Cooper?
A.J. Gonzalez.
I've been aware of police giving false testimony for decades in Santa Cruz court. So I don't think it dates back to Obama or anything in particular. I think Obama is
Act that they passed to okay it, and it's called the Ellis Act, which is kind of funny because it's Spanglish for the lies.
Well, I know an Ellis Act I know of has to do with giving landlords a lot of power that was passed in the 90s, but I'm not familiar with the act you're talking about. But so you're saying that you're not sure what's going to happen, but what do you intend to do? Do you have another spot mapped out that you're going to go to?
I guess if we're catching them more on human trafficking, we'll go ahead and let them arrest us, and we'll set them up again. They've been set up numerous times for writing bogus tickets, kidnapping, places that we have had the law on our side, the real law, and they don't like that. And so that's why I sit there and let them arrest me. They get set up. So if they're going to do it again tomorrow, they can come do it again, and they can arrest us and steal our stuff again and be part of human trafficking.
Cooper, is there any...
somebody will come and help the people.
Cooper, have you had any... I'd be nice if that were true. You have more faith than I do. But I know that I'm wondering if you've had any contact with any other folks who might give you legal support, or even, you know, support like was given to people who were in the Benchlands area or in the Duck Pond area way back when, 2 or 3 years ago, you know, when there was actually a community support for people who were living there. Although I think, you know, they went after you anyway.
We have a really good community of our people here. The police don't even live in Santa Cruz. So they're ordered by the judge to come and round up people for the courtroom because they don't have that much crime.
What I've seen in the past...
Not enough for the judge to be in an exact...
What I've seen in the past, Cooper, what I've seen in the past is that people in the Poganip and along Highway 9 and along the Benchlands and elsewhere generally leave. They do not resist. Very, very few get arrested. You're one of the few. So I'm wondering, right. do you expect there's going to be a change this time? Do you expect more people will say, yeah, take me to jail?
I actually don't think they're showing up at all.
I see. Okay, that's your thought.
I really hope that news hits tomorrow and that we get some help from above.
Well, you know, if you can, and if your phone is operational, and I'm impressed that you have a phone. You don't usually have a phone.
I know, it's Russell's. Actually, I'm impressed we get
Oh, well, thank Russell.
Here.
Thank Russell for me. Call tomorrow, if and when this is happening, and I'm not sure what we can do up here in beautiful Felton, but maybe, you know, we can try to get down there, though I'm not much one for hiking up hills these days. But, you know, at least I can record, you know, your account of what's going on, if you want.
And we'll see. So everybody's hanging tight, and they want you to run. That's how they get you to negate on your own constitutional rights.
I agree. Yeah.
Is that they want you to be scared and run and be scared of being incarcerated. And most of the 99.9% of the time, they can't take you at all. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and we've experienced this before where they've threatened, we'll take your stuff, we'll take you to jail, and we don't move and they can't do a thing because all it is smoke and mirrors and lies.
How many have moved already?
Just one.
And so most people are staying in place.
Yep.
Well, that's, you know, I mean, that's impressive. Is there any support coming from other groups like, in the old days?
Well, Monarch Services, if the police tried to take us tomorrow, I would call Monarch Services while the police are here, and I would get the women out of this camp and tell the Monarch Services that we are being threatened and human trafficked out of safe housing and into a concentration camp, and that is one of the services that Monarch Services does for women is human trafficking.
Well, tell us a little bit.
They are wonderful.
Tell us a little bit.
When I was released from jail,
yeah,
I made a phone call, and they met me at a hotel. They paid for a hotel. She gave me a big bag of all these, like, food and, you know, soap and shampoo and all this, you know, a hairbrush, all these toiletries and goodies,
mm-hmm.
Sweatpants, a shirt, you know, socks. Just, they are wonderful people.
Have you contacted them about this issue that's coming up tomorrow?
I either may call tonight to give them a heads up that I'll be calling tomorrow and how many women that we'll need shelter for.
How many women are there there?
Let's see, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Out of a population of about 30?
Bad to the bone.
Well, I wish you luck with them. I don't know much about what. Do you have any idea what? I know you have this personal experience with Monarch Services, but do they? What do they advertise that they do? Supposedly,
they do. Let's see. I have their card here. And they're very aware of what the police are doing. Criminal. I was very happy to know that they're very aware. They're very much on the side of the right.
What kind of a service are they?
Not the third right, just the right.
Right.
They do peer counseling. They do legal assistance and advocacy. They do resources for survivors of sexual assault, domestic violence, and human trafficking.
So today, being Monday, this was when Food Now Bombs had its meeting. I don't get to their meetings much, but you might want to contact Keith McHenry and let him know. Do you want his number?
I've got Keith's number. The only one I don't have that I thought would come up is Abby.
And I
don't even know if she's in town.
I don't know either. I heard that she was in Spain at one point, but that could have been some months ago. I don't know. you might...
And Dread, I might still have her number, but it's written in one of my other books in storage.
I saw Dread Eye yesterday at the Food Now Bombs meal, but do you have his number?
Yeah, he's just parked down the street.
Well, I'd say
that... He's just parked down the street. He'll help us out with her number if you don't have it.
And possibly you could contact, no idea how active she is, but Alicia Cool, you know.
Yeah, and Russ did contact her, but I think she's just got so much going on with the family and stuff that she's out of the loop. Because you're not homeless anymore. Sometimes you lose the passion, I think, when people get so far away from the crisis.
Yep.
You know, they're kind of like, well. And it's, you know...
Other things occupy your attention. So yeah.
Yeah.
Have you had any success? Any sense of whether this is happening to other encampments elsewhere? Have you heard anything about that?
Well, they already did do it to Miri Lagoon, because we have a lot of the families. There were some families of people, dads and kids, older kids, but families that were living together there. And then they came up to join us here.
And that was about a week ago?
About maybe 2.5, 3.
And how many people?
3 weeks.
How many people were ousted from Neary Lagoon, do you know?
I don't know. I don't know.
And any other places where people went? And because a lot of folks were, rousted from the Highway 9 area. And I'm just wondering where, I know some of them.
It's any kind of freedom camp. That's what they're rousting them out. Because they've got people in tents on Highway 9 at Jeremy Leonard's camp. They're not rousting them out. Again, it's a concentration camp, and people's lives are managed, micromanaged.
You're talking about 1220. You're talking about 1220 River Street again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's on any kind of freedom camp is what they attack.
Well, what I'm saying though is
they
what
can't
I'm saying
make
what
money
I'm
on freedom.
Cooper, what I'm saying is that a lot of the folks who were on Highway 9, there was a lot more than 30. And the 30 that are with you.
There's people up Highway 9. That's a whole different camp.
So there is another camp on Highway 9 now, saying?
Yeah. They're still there.
You're not talking about 1220 River then?
No.
And how are they doing? Are they being threatened?
As far as I know, no.
And how many?
Or easier for the cops to get to.
And how many are they, would you estimate, if you have any idea?
People in the other camps?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. There's usually at least a group of 10.
Uh-huh. Well...
I don't know. Because I know we have campers above us, too, in the Poconos, and cops went up there, too. And most of it was the first day, court date for the judge. Everybody in the courtroom for bogus tickets. And then the second time was eviction with the motive of concentration camp and taking people's freedom. And to break up the unity. Because we're a strong crew, unified. We don't do it for the pay. And we don't get a day off. So we're a holy crew. And I don't think they like the unity.
Cooper, can
the
you
real,
give me...
holy war, you know, good and evil.
Cooper, can you give me Russell's number?
If I could.
Okay.
I don't know it.
Does he know it?
No. This is his phone, but he's not right here.
Okay.
I guess what I can do is have him text it to you later.
Let me give you another number to text it to, because this phone doesn't take text. My phone is a landline. It doesn't take text. So
ready to track people by their phone. That's why.
No problem, babe.
All these free things coming to the poor.
No problem. So is there anything you want to add before I ring off, as they say?
No, we just hope for some good things to come tomorrow, and maybe tonight will be New Year's Eve and Christmas Eve. We might have some good news, maybe on the 10 o'clock news. Who knows? I just hope so.
Well, I wish you luck with that. And my views, of course, are much darker. But please keep me advised, and I'll be call me tomorrow if you can. Don't text me, but call me, and I'll pick up the conversation.
Okay.
No, thank you, Cooper.
Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye. And to maintain the illusion of suspense, we'll be playing more of this, the three conversations I had, one on each successive day. Well, three of them all in a row in successive days. But let's have a musical break now, and here we go. The song you're about to hear is called From Kabul to Khartoum. And Rovix writes, sanctions on Iraq have been going on for many years, causing the untimely deaths of hundreds of thousands of predominantly Iraqi Muslim men, women, and children. But when the USS Cole was attacked, the Western media painted the event as if an innocent U.S. Navy ship was attacked by crazed, bearded Muslims because they hate our freedom. And then the Clinton administration's military assaults in Afghanistan and Sudan on August 21, 1998, that followed were painted as retaliation. Of course, by definition, the U.S. and the U.K., Israel, France, etc., are always retaliating, never initiating. The bombing of the pharmaceutical factory in Sudan had a devastating effect on the entire region, since there was no way for the government of Sudan to replace the loss of the drugs that the factory had been producing.
From Guatemala to Korea, to the tunnels beneath Hanoi, from Tulsa to El Cerrito, fat man to little boy. We fought them in Nicaragua and upon the Cuban shore. Killed Gaddafi's daughter, see what the fatwa's got in store. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? From Kabul to Khartoum, where Allah's martyrs bled, to the Iraqi desert, 200,000 people dead. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? From the school of the assassins to Argentina's dirty war, from Arizona to Nevada, we'll nuke our way to heaven's door. We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see? We're gonna bomb our way to freedom with the cruise missiles of justice and the spent shells of democracy. Oh, say, can you see?
And you'll be listening to George Cadman, a one-time free radio broadcaster who's now apparently regular Talk of the Bay Thursday show. She actually does two shows a week. I haven't been listening to K-Squid, almost never listen to the radio these days, but you get to hear her show. Her guest is Sarah Leonard of MHCAN, that's Mental Health Clients Advisory Network, as mentioned before, so here it comes.
And you are listening to Talk of the Bay here at KSQD 90.7 FM. My name is George Cadman. I'm your host for today's Talk of the Bay. And today we're joined by Sarah Leonard. She is the Executive Director of MHCAN, the Mental Health Client Action Network. She's been the Executive Director for almost 11 years. 10 years and 11 months, to be exact. MH Can is a peer-run drop-in center and nonprofit organization serving people with behavioral health diagnoses, including mental health and substance use disorders. Sarah loves her work and enjoys the MH Can team immensely. She is a certified drug and alcohol counselor who has 33 years clean and sober. She's been diagnosed with many mental health issues in her lifetime, from being developmentally differently abled to having paranoid schizophrenia, autism, bipolar disorder, gender dysphoria, depression, OCD, and a chronic acute PTSD. Sarah Leonard graduated from UCSC in 1991 with honors, with a BA in creative writing and literature. She has two daughters, cats, a dog, geese, chicken, doves, and ducks. Hello, Sarah Leonard. Thank you for joining me today on Talk of the Bay.
Hello, and just to be clear, it's honors in the major, which is different than graduating with honors.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. I appreciate the correction. So let us start with my visit to MH Can today. I stopped by. I lived in the neighborhood, and it, just to say where it's located, it's at the corner of Cayuga and Soquel in Santa Cruz.
Yes, at 1051 Cayuga.
1051 Cayuga. I've seen the building for years, and it's like a beige kind of nondescript office building. And I had a roommate at one time when I lived nearby a few blocks away who would go and get some of the food pantry food and things. But I'd never been there.
Yeah.
And since I was planning on having you on today, I thought, oh, this is time to go and actually go to this place. And I was surprised, delighted, actually, to see how big it was inside. And
it's huge. It's a huge building.
Yeah. And how many different services you offer and all of the... I walked in and they were serving, 10 or 12 hot pizzas
from Costco
to folks, yeah. And from Costco, and there was a pool table, and there was like a place to lock up your stuff with combination locks, and there was a library, and it was amazing, and a whole kitchen, and I was even introduced to some of the companion animals, and that was really wonderful. I met some cats. I can't remember their names. Maybe you can help me out with that.
Alexander, Jack, and Kitty.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I guess let's start with some of the services that you offer, because I think a lot of people go past MH Can, and maybe you see one or two folks outside, but it's not clear what it is. It doesn't have, I mean, there is a sign, but if you don't really know about it, it's kind of just another building. So maybe you could fill me in on just some of, we'll get into detail, but just maybe talk about some of the different things that you offer.
Sure. Well, first, every morning when we open up, we have breakfast, we have food, and we have coffee. We have transportation services where people can be picked up to come to MH Can. We have transportation services where people can be helped if they're moving from one place to another or in and out of a storage unit. And we also do trips if people have operations in Salinas or Hollister or San Jose. As long as we know in advance, we can pick people up and take them to surgeries, to family events, and even to something that they've always wanted to do, like go to the zoo in San Francisco.
And the folks that are doing this driving, are they staff members?
Staff members.
Okay.
Yeah, staff members.
So I'm assuming that they have to have a good driving record.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so
absolutely.
Like any other job where you're a driver, you would have to have these...
Absolutely.
Meet those qualifications. Okay. And then, so when the transportation, is there any kind of limitation on that? Like, is there a distance?
So
I'm not going to take you to New York City.
Well, you might be amazed. We've actually picked up members who were in distress from Santa Barbara. And we've also had people go on field trips to Los Angeles. So we actually are willing to go wherever people are willing to want to go within reason.
And is this like, does the organization have like a van, or is this like people's personal vehicles that they're transporting?
We have a van. We actually had two vehicles until recently, and now we just have one. But hopefully in the future we'll have more. For years we've gotten grants from the Department of Transportation, Caltrans, and we actually have been a regular Caltrans provider for transport of people who are differently abled, which we are, for years. So
I imagine some of the folks that are needing a ride they just don't have a driver's license for whatever reason, or they're just not able to drive a vehicle for some reason.
If you have a severe mental illness, quote-unquote, if you have a severe mental health diagnosis, or maybe you've had a severe addiction, or you're an alcoholic where you've had your license taken away, there's lots of reasons why people can be very capable mentally and at the same time be in a space where they're not able to drive.
One of my sisters never had a driver's license because she tried driving, you know, to learn and just realized she was too distracted and didn't believe she could safely drive, so she just never had one. So, yeah, there can be situations like that as well where people just decide, hey, driving isn't for me.
Yeah, and sometimes other people decide for them. Like in my own situation, my father tried to teach me to drive and I kept closing my eyes.
Okay.
So he decided that wasn't the best thing. But a few years later, I was stable and balanced enough to be able to learn to drive just like anyone else, and I've driven ever since.
Mm.
So sometimes it's a temporary situation where someone is having mental health difficulties, and then it passes, and they can learn and grow and move on.
Mm-hmm.
But besides transportation, we have support groups, we have art groups, we have one-on-one counseling, peer counseling, peer support. We have seeking safety, which is around PTSD. We have AA and NA meetings, which are, you know, recovery support, sobriety support meetings. And we also have, at different times, we've had many different religiously or spiritually themed groups. We've had Wiccan groups and Christian groups and Buddhist groups and even satanic groups. Mm-hmm. At the time, the only kind of group of that kind that we have going on right now is a Christian group that's very well attended and well loved.
And a Christian group, what do you mean by
it's
that?
It's like a Bible study.
Oh.
Peers can start a group if they want to start a group. So although some groups are led by staff, some are led by peers.
Peers, meaning clients,
a member of the community.
Seeking services or benefiting from services.
A member of the community. Yeah.
Okay, great. So I want to get into more detail on the services you offer, because there are many.
We have a computer room. We also accept mail. So at the local shelter, they actually charge people to get their mail picked up there.
People?
They charge people who are unhoused to pick up their mail. And at MHCAN, we don't charge people to pick up mail.
Huh.
So we pick up mail. We get mail for about 500 people.
You mean you act as their address?
We act as their address.
Okay.
And that gives them access to a lot of resources. A lot of times you need an address to be able to move on in different stages of different services.
Uh-huh.
And
one of the locations that I saw inside the two-story building, which, again, this is thought was so colorful and wonderful, you had... I mean, I really had to be careful not to take a bunch of photos, because I was just like, this is amazing, this is so cool. All these quotes and the artwork, it seemed like a lot of it came from folks that, you know, are peers at the center. It's just a beautiful, colorful place filled with colorful people with art. But the computer room was pretty cool. I don't remember the staff member you introduced me to, her name. But she was telling me, what's her
Blair.
Name?
Blair.
I'll
just say her first name because she's actually a little bit shy about her name.
Okay. But she was very enthusiastic to tell me all about the computer room and about what people seek there when they're going to the computer room. So could you talk a little bit about, like, people need help getting a resume together, applying for services, et cetera.
And also looking for housing. I'm going on Craigslist, checking all of the different housing places to see when something comes available. And one thing that she's just magical at is that she used to work in a phone kiosk. So if anyone is having any kind of problem whatsoever with their cell phone, she can fix literally anything. And she's just brilliant when it comes to cell phones, which is for most people their main, you know, means of cyber communication these days.
Yes.
So
I can attest to that. I rely on my cell phone for email and texting and all kinds of things. searching the internet, preparing for radio shows, all kinds of stuff. So Blair, she was explaining to me that a lot of folks with mental health diagnoses or substance abuse issues can struggle with things like computer literacy. And so she says she's there because she can guide them through some of the technology they're not terribly familiar with.
She's also going above and beyond in another regard, in that she's actually helping some people learn to read.
Oh.
So one population that we serve that most people don't realize is that a huge amount of the people that come to MHCAN are former foster children. They're people who grew up in the foster system. And when you grow up in the foster system, quite often you move around. And because you move around a lot, your schooling isn't necessarily as, you know, beautifully consecutive and as one would wish. So we do have a lot of people who have problems with literacy. And Blair has actually gone ahead and has been literally teaching people to read.
Wow.
Which is beautiful. I mean,
and
I think
how
it's
does
a beautiful
she how does she approach that? Is she doing it with the computer, or is she using physical books or magazines or newspapers? All of it. Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. How many staff members do you have? We've talked about you. You're the executive director, and Blair, who's doing the computers and IT stuff. But you introduced me to several other folks that you said were on staff. So roughly how many folks do you have?
So at our highest point since I've been there, we've had 32 people on staff and 85 stipend workers. And since the pandemic, we've been rather low. Something that's important to realize with that is that the vast majority of the people who work at MHCAN are part-time, because for the most part, they're only able to be part-time because they might lose their housing if they make too much money, or that they're not able, or that they might lose their health, that it's simply not healthy for them to work more than part-time. We only have 4 full-time workers, and everyone else who works there, probably, I think right now we're at 14 people. So 10 people are part-time and 4 people are full-time. But until a couple of years ago, I was the only full-time
staff member. Another way that I heard of MHCAN was I met someone who's no longer employed with you, but Wendy. She was your art director, right?
Wendy is wonderful. Wendy Martin actually works at Telecare, which is the psychiatric health facility in town, and she's a wonderful, wonderful artist, and she brings her art and her heart to every single shift that she works. She works with the acutely distressed inside the locked ward, and she does a wonderful job.
Are you seeking a replacement for her? Because you mentioned earlier that you no longer have someone running the art program. Is that right?
No. So she worked for us inside of the unit, but we no longer have that contract. They actually cut a 10-year contract in the end of June, which was a surprise. But I'm very glad that Wendy continued there, because she's just... She's a committed, wonderful person whose heart is really in her work.
But she no longer works at MHCAN.
No.
So do you have an art program at MHCAN?
We do not currently have an art program at MHCAN, but we have one art class with a longtime peer who's very passionate about her work.
Let's talk about some of those classes and some of the services. I'm assuming these are open to the public, whether you've had a diagnosis or not, or do you have to have had a diagnosis?
So we are not open to the general public.
Why not?
So one of the reasons for that is because people in the general public can treat us very badly, and quite often historically tend to treat us not quite as well as perhaps they treat other people. So we're careful about... letting people on our campus, so to speak, so that people are not distressed by the way that they're treated. One of the problems that we have in maintaining a balance at MHCAN is that because we offer so many wonderful services and so many wonderful services that appeal to people who are unhoused, that we'll have quite a lot of unhoused people who don't quite have the significant history that is part of MHCAN. And you might think, and we often think, oh, that's fine, let everybody in, you know, who needs it. But the problem with people who are more normal is that they want to kick those of us out who aren't. And so we'll have people who have acute schizophrenia, who have the characteristics of acute schizophrenia, who are much beloved members of our community who've been there forever. And then if you let in some people who are unhoused perhaps, but rather normal, within a day or two, they'll be saying, can you kick that person out? They're distressing me. The way they're acting is distressing me. When that person is acting completely normally for a person with schizophrenia.
Oh, I see.
So we have to be careful to protect our members. And often the people who are the most normal are the most aggressive in trying to enforce normality. So those of us who are aware of that, it's always trying to maintain that balance of protection, because our most symptomatic, quote-unquote, clients, our most distressed clients, are often the ones who are the most vulnerable and who are literally verbally attacked the most by newcomers.
You're listening to Talk of the Bay. My name is George Cadman. I'm your host today. I'm joined by Sarah Leonard. She's been the executive director of the Mental Health Client Action Network, or MHCAN, for nearly 11 years now. It's a peer-run drop-in center and nonprofit organization serving people with behavioral health diagnoses, including mental health and substance use disorders. And we've been talking about their services that they offer to those folks and the community there and the campus, as Sarah says. So I'm thinking, if you don't have a mental health diagnosis or substance use disorder, and you want to come to the center for some other reason, like say you're houseless and you want to use a computer, are you saying that that is not, because one of the descriptions of MHCAN is that it's a drop-in center, so it makes it sound kind of like anyone, but you're saying it's not for everyone. So how do you, quote-unquote, police that? Like, do you stop someone at the door and say, what is your mental health? I mean, I'm just trying to figure out how things operate.
So, in general, we're a gateway for county mental health, so there are some places, Community Connection is another drop-in center, but it's referral only, and it's a wonderful, wonderful place, but it's referral only.
Community Connection.
Yes, it's run by the Volunteer Center. It's a lovely drop-in center, but it's you cannot get there basically unless you're a member of County Mental Health.
Referred
directly from County Mental Health.
Got it.
With MHCAN, anyone can walk in the door, but to stay, you do need to belong. And when I said that before about the vulnerable members, generally someone will make themselves known as being, like I said, too normal if they'll literally provoke people and then try to get them kicked out. And people do that with people who are radically different. And it's unfortunate, but it seems to be part of the human condition.
So it's more of a situation where if you notice that someone who is coming to the center is creating problems, is trying to create division, or is doing is pointing someone out as a, quote, problem because they have a mental health condition, that person, you may take them aside and say, how would you handle that situation?
So we also do intakes. We do have a membership.
Oh.
And so to come to MHCAN, you're supposed to become a member. It can take a few weeks. If we know that someone, obviously, we feel that they belong there, we'll give them more time to do an intake, especially if we think that someone has a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia like I do. Mm-hmm. Because if you're paranoid, sometimes you need a little more time to not feel that you're being targeted or picked out in particular, or feel like, well, are they giving everyone these intakes? So sometimes with someone with schizophrenia, we'll give them a little bit longer. But if we're not sure about someone, if they really belong or not, we'll go and we'll talk to them. And we'll do an intake with them, and we'll ask them straight out, you know, what is your history? Do you have a history of mental health diagnoses? Do you have a history of behavioral health diagnoses? And sometimes we're able to help people with referrals to other organizations. We are a county-funded organization. That's our main bread and butter. It doesn't fund everything, unfortunately, but it funds a lot. And it's directly in our county contract that if people are not appropriate for membership, that we must refer them on.
Okay.
Otherwise, we could potentially lose our contract.
Okay, so let's say I'm a member of the community that has a mental health diagnosis or a substance use disorder, and I have some, you know, history with that. behavioral health, and I come to you because I don't have a computer at home, or I'm living in my car, or I just want to see what kinds of you know, art. I want to go to an art class. I want to meet other people and feel in a community.
Yeah.
How would I approach that? Because I know you have open hours. You're open. It's listed on your website. Maybe you could talk about your open hours, and also talk about how someone may approach you for themselves, or perhaps they may perhaps approach you for a family member or a friend that they think might benefit from your organization's services.
Well, we're open Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday from 9 a.m. to 2. Anyone can just walk in. We're at 1051 Cayuga, but we're actually set back from the street, so you have to kind of walk into the parking lot, and then there's this huge pepper tree, and we're over to the right under the pepper tree. And anyone can come in. If people want to come in and talk about what's going on with a family member who has mental health or behavioral health diagnoses, they're welcome to do that with staff. We're also open on Wednesdays by appointment for one-on-ones with staff, or for special groups sometimes, or special events that we have.
So what is your website and what is your phone number? Because those would be other ways folks could start. You know, if they're not, say perhaps they're a little reticent to just walk in, they want to call you first or check out your website, how would they do that?
Our website is www.mhcan.org. That's www.mhcan.org. And our phone number is 469-0462. That's 469-0462. And we definitely take a lot of phone calls. Sometimes we don't get to call people back right away because we're really slammed with people.
When I called a few days ago, someone answered, and I said I was with the media, and they immediately handed the phone to you. So I guess I called it a good time because I got hold of somebody right away.
Yeah.
And when I came in today, it was a very welcoming space.
Yeah.
And it was really, really nice. So tell us a little more about the history. We talked a little bit about the history of the organization, but maybe give us a little nutshell version of how long you've been around and how it got started, what was the idea, maybe what your mission statement or mission, your purpose as you see it is, as the organization sees it.
So MHCAN actually started from the very beginning with a UCSC student group called PIRC, P-I-R-C, which stood for Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective. And they were really like the godparent of MHCAN. They were the very beginning. There was a group of UCSC students, and they used to meet as a group. And the more they met over time, one of the people in that group lived near Emmeline in a camper. And there began to be an accumulation of people who had mental health diagnoses that would gather in community to hang out and support each other.
What year roughly was that?
This was in the 1970s and then in the 80s.
Wow.
So
PIRC, Psychiatric
Inmate Rights Collective. And over time, this became noticed by the County of Santa Cruz and by a group of peers that wanted to work with the system, which was very opposite of what PIRC was, very anti-system in general.
And by system, you mean?
The psychiatric system, the mental health system.
Okay.
So there are people who designate themselves as a psychiatric survivor because they went through a traumatic experience with the psychiatric system. I myself am a psychiatric survivor. I was put against my will into a locked ward. So someone who has that kind of experience is very different than someone who is medication compliant and who wants to be in a ward, or who wants to see a psychiatrist. Someone who's being forced to do things against their will is exactly why they came up with the name Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective.
And a little apologetic about interrupting Sarah as she gets into the good stuff. Here's a little musical break anyway.
There's an election on again, and it's terrible to see the farce they call American democracy. On the left is someone who is to the right of Tony Blair. On the right is a neo-fascist, narcissistic billionaire. At least within the corporate press, it's all about these two, the candidates who got all the dollar signs in view. Meanwhile, off the spectrum is someone they don't mention. They don't think the Republic can handle the dissension. The only progressive woman You'll see listed in most states the only one whose dinners cost a couple bucks a week. The only one whose platform makes any sense to me. The only one I like to picture running the country. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They said I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. On the one hand, a guy who believes in getting rich at any price. On the other, a warmonger who makes Thatcher look nice. Or you can vote the party that will bring full employment as it cuts the military budget by over 50% with the Green Jobs Program all across the country so we can pull back from the brink with renewable energy because the future is clear. We won't have one if we don't have a government that can get the job done. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. You could roll over, play dead, vote for the 1%, and wonder in the future where your world went. Or you can go with your conscience, give it a try. Before Trump and Clinton kill us, we gotta kiss it all goodbye. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. I'm voting for Jill Stein.
And, of course, Green Party this year picked Cornel West, who also was picked by the People's Party for the upcoming 2024 election. But it looks like the election is going to be a replay of 2016 and 2020 to me. So the song is pertinent. Cornel West's positions are pretty much similar to those of Jill Stein in the wars in Ukraine. Defund the police to some extent, although I'm not sure if he's actually come out with that as a specific set of proposals. U.S. out of Ukraine, U.S. out of NATO, NATO backup from the Russian border, neutrality in Ukraine, and I guess my focus is a lot on Ukraine. But let's get back to Sarah Leonard on K-Squid.
They were focusing on their rights not to be locked up, to have, they were anti-commitment. They were pro-voluntary commitment only and anti-electric shock. So this group was a really strong group that lasted for years, and the more that they met, the more that other people in the community became aware of them, and a group was actually formed that worked with the Henry James Foundation in San Francisco with the help of the behavioral health, mental health at Building K at Emmeline. They actually helped form MHCAN with the William James Society of San Francisco. So it was incorporated in 1995, August 11th, and it's been around now ever since.
1995 is when MHCAN officially became a nonprofit.
A nonprofit for public benefit corporation. And we actually, we still have some members of PERC that stop by from time to time and kind of tell us that we sold out. and it's really nice to see them and hear from them because I still consider them the beginnings of MHCAN.
They were the folks that were against working within the psychiatric
system. And now we're primarily funded by the system.
Tell me more about this idea of a psychiatric system, because I think folks that haven't been in either voluntarily institutionalized or involuntarily institutionalized or have sought medication or have had it forced on them, like,
there, you're saying that in the beginning, this organization that preceded MHCAN, PIRC, Psychiatric Inmate Rights Collective, had a division in the group between folks who were, you know,
willing to work with the system and people who were anti-system.
What is the system? So, can we break that down a little bit more?
Sure. So the system is the mental health system, and especially that incorporated by the county. I feel that we're very lucky at this time. The system has changed even in the time that I've been here. A few years ago, there was a lot of over-medication. People would... in the system, psychiatrists at different places that are called step downs from the hospital, they would routinely heavily medicate people to keep them behaviorally compliant, which was distressing and inappropriate in my regard. Now that does not happen. It has really, the system locally has become much more conscionable, much more ethical. The people who work in it have become much more self-aware of everything that they do and what the system does. Building K is at Emmeline, the Emmeline complex at the end of Emmeline Street. And anyone who has psychiatric issues that are really hurting them and hurting in their family, you can walk in there and you can get help as long as you don't already have private insurance.
You know, Building K is like the behavioral health building?
There's a giant, if you go down Emmeline Street, it's the very last building. It has a giant K at the front of it. And you can walk in between 8 and noon, and between 1 and 4, you can ask for the access team. And then you can be evaluated to see what are your needs as far as behavioral health. Do you need to go to a rehab? Do you need to go to a mental health facility and really spend some time learning yourself a little bit better?
This is really good information, have to say, because a lot of people have no idea where to go when they're experiencing an emergency psychiatric, or they're having a substance abuse issue, or they don't have health insurance. You know, there's all kinds of layers. Like, is that a good starting point, that building?
It's a wonderful starting point. Mm-hmm. And they now have things that they didn't used to have, like they have the emergency response team, so that if someone who's already in the system is having a really hard time, that instead of having to call the police or someone like that, they can actually call their own team that will go out and help people without them having to go through the trauma of dealing with law enforcement. There's also mental health counselors who are embedded on the police teams locally. I think that
like social workers?
They're mental health workers. I think that MERT is a better... And what I see is that when I've encountered the mental health person on the police team, the police are always in charge and kind of always directing what's happening. And MERT, I think,
what's
is a
MERT?
Much cleaner model.
What's MERT?
It stands for Emergency Response Team.
Emergency Response Team. But do we have that here?
Yes, we do. We do. And it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And they've done things as you know, when someone's in crisis, it doesn't always mean like, oh, I've got a knife and I'm going to stab myself. It might mean I'm completely out of my medication that keeps me stable, and my psychiatrist is on vacation, and the pharmacist says I'm out of stuff. The MERT team can actually go in there and refill that prescription for them from a psychiatrist on their team. And so it sounds like, well, is that an emergency? It is. I mean, when someone knows that this medication really helps them and keeps them stable and they're out and they're not going to have it again for a week or two, I've just seen MERT do some things that are really wonderful, and that might sound not very exciting, but it really is good.
So MERT is like medical emergency response team?
Mental health.
Mental health.
Yeah, it's a mental health response team in the county system.
And is that based in Building K?
It is based in Building K.
Emmeline Street.
Yeah, and they've also been, South County used to not have its own mental health complex, and now it has a beautiful one that they built a few years ago, and they've also been increasing children's services.
And where is the South County location?
The South County location is in Watsonville.
In Watsonville.
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'll remind folks, you're listening to Talk of the Bay here at 90.7 FM, KSQD. Unfortunately, we don't appear to have a call screener today. I had hoped to take calls, but we don't have one. So, sorry about that, listeners. but hopefully next week, next Tuesday when I'm here, I'll try to arrange to have someone come in. Anyway, I'm joined by Sarah Leonard. Again, she is the Executive Director of the Mental Health Client Action Network, or MHCAN. She's been the Executive Director for nearly 11 years now. MHCAN is a peer-run drop-in center and nonprofit organization serving people with behavioral health diagnoses, including mental health and substance use disorders. We've been talking a little bit about the history of MHCAN, which again was officially became a nonprofit organization in 1995, but had its start in the 70s and 80s with the Psychiatric Inmate Rights Collective. That was pretty interesting. I had no idea about that. So why don't you tell us, how did you become the executive director of MHCAN 10 years and 11 months ago now?
Well, at the time, so years back, I mean, when I was a child, I was diagnosed with autism at age 3, and then at age 9, I was already involved in mental health activism. I was in, my father was a founding member of the Long Beach Mental Health Association, and I was actually a member of the Long Beach Mental Health Association when I was 9 years old. I was seeing a psychiatrist at the time for suicidal depression, and I helped make a slideshow with him on depression that was shown in Long Beach area schools.
And your father, you mentioned that to me when we were talking previously, earlier today, that both of your parents have PhDs.
Yes.
What was your father? Was he a professor?
He was a professor of Indian history, and we lived in India when I was little, so my first languages were Hindi and Urdu, not English.
That's so interesting.
Yeah. But,
so when you were living back in the States, you moved to the Southern California. He taught at UC San Diego, right?
He did teach at UC San Diego, and then he was actually blacklisted for opposing the Vietnam War and for holding sit-ins in his classes. So he was blacklisted out of academia forever. But my mother went on to have a long, very, very significant career at UC Irvine. She became a professor 4, which is the highest tier, and it means that she has worldwide respect in her field.
What was she?
Indian history as well.
Also.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I was very mentally distressed from a very young age. When I was 17, I was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and when I was 19, I was diagnosed with bipolar. I was also diagnosed with selective mutism, PTSD, and OCD. So I had all of these different diagnoses, and at that time in my life, around 19, 20, going to college, I desperately wanted to be normal for one reason, and that was so that I wouldn't get locked up against my will again, because I had found that very distressing.
And that happened to you when you were in your teens?
When I was 17, yeah. I was told that I was going in to have a few tests that would take an hour, and instead I was led into a locked ward, told I was being given a tour. And then they showed me to a room and said, "This is your room."
And your mother was the one who put you in the institution. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
So do you think she chose 17 because you were about to turn 18? What was her motivation?
So I was actually a few days before I turned 18, they had a meeting and they decided that I was going to be committed to a state mental hospital for a long-term conservatorship of about 2 years. UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute. And they decided that I would be committed and that the state of California would be my guardian, so I would be conserved. And instead, the next day, I went AWOL, and I made my own life. So that was my background.
When you turned 18.
Yeah. And for years, I just wanted to stay off the radar and not get locked up because I was terrified of being given electric shock therapy, which was really popular at the time. And actually, my first girlfriend in high school, she was given electric shock therapy against her will.
What led up to, if you don't mind my asking, what led up to your mother choosing to essentially deceive you and lock you up against her will at 17? What led up to that?
So at the time, I genuinely fit the diagnostic criteria for paranoid schizophrenia. I absolutely have a authentic diagnosis in that regard. I have never disputed that. I believe that the entire world was aliens and that I was one of the only last human beings on Earth. I used to burn my feet with cigarettes and my hands, and I used to cut out the bottom of my shoes and tie the laces around, and so then I would have bloody footprints wherever
I walked. So in retrospect, even though it was painful at the time, have you, I guess, forgiven your mother for
Absolutely. I love my mother dearly. She's one of my greatest advocates and one of my greatest friends in the world. I love my mother dearly.
And does she live here?
She lives in Los Angeles.
In L.A.?
Yeah. So I had this history of being, feeling that I couldn't show who I was. I had to hide who I was in order to survive in this world and not get locked up. And I ended up working at a place called the Respite House, which is also in Santa Cruz. I was the second employee hired and one of the founding members. And when I was working there, the person who used to run MHCAN left. And what happened was all of a sudden I had 12 different people tell me, you should go for that job. We need you to do that job. You would be good at that job. Sarah, you should go for that job. And at the time, the first few people, I was like, well, no, I'm not qualified. That's really weird. You know, why would I want to do that? And literally, I let myself be convinced by other people, including this one young woman that I barely knew who was just convinced that I ought to do it. So I actually went for the interview, and during the interview, one of the people who was doing the interviewing had a heart attack on the board. And
goodness.
That was
in the interview?
In the interview, Joy McCorkle, who is now passed. And she said that she wouldn't go to the hospital until they hired me. And she meant it. And she actually stayed there and argued until I was hired. So she always used to tell me, I got you your job. She used to shake her finger at me and go, I got you your job.
Well, you must be doing something right to be in the job almost 11 years
but
now.
But she was lovely. And she actually, I have her ashes I have her ashes now. I carry them around with me. She became my friend. I didn't know her at the time, but she had watched me. I'd been volunteering at MHCAN, taking people hiking.
So tell me, you said you were working at, what was it, Respite House?
Yeah.
Prior to MHCAN?
Correct.
Tell me just a teeny bit about Respite House, because I've never heard of it, and you say it's in Santa Cruz. Is it still around?
It is in Santa Cruz, and it probably needs its own show.
Okay. But you were previously employed there, and that was
I'd been working as a drug and alcohol counselor and as a mental health counselor. I'd been working as a DUI clerk and admin
like
support. I volunteered there for 3 years, and then I worked as a DUI clerk, admin support, and
So you didn't feel like you were qualified at first for the executive director positions. You had to be kind of nudged into applying.
Yeah.
But there was clearly quite a few people who saw your abilities.
Yeah.
So is that something you think that happens a lot with folks with mental health diagnoses, that they, with the stigma, we could talk a little bit about stigma, just that I think it can sometimes make people feel like, hey, I don't know if I can do that thing.
I think we're taught not to believe in ourselves, and in fact we're told outright not to believe in ourselves. The first thing that happened when I was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia was I was told that I would never live on my own, I would never have a job, I would always need to be on medication the rest of my life, and none of that turned out to be true. I hold two jobs, I own my own house, I've raised my own children. And those are things that you're told that you cannot do, or that you won't do, or that won't happen. So.
Right. In terms of medication, that can be a difficult thing for some folks. And I think maybe we could talk a little bit about medication, because you said that sometimes folks are told they can't, they'll never function without it, but it sounds like some people get to a point where they can taper off or whatever. So it's obviously a personal thing, and I'm not talking about, like, specifics here, but just, I guess when there is stigma attached, I think, to folks using or needing medication, even folks with diagnoses can sometimes be distrustful of medication or feel like it's losing their power or control and taking some of their freedom away. Could we talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
Generally?
I think that inside of the system, it's the opposite, that there's a great distrust of people who aren't on medication. And that outside of the system, it's if you have a diagnosis that people tend to be prejudiced against you. But in many countries, medication is treated differently than it is in the United States, especially in regard to schizophrenia. and in regard to other diagnoses as well. But in most countries, schizophrenia is seen as a passing condition.
Good stuff. Of course, for folks who are in HUF, the issue has always been for MH Can, or for me anyway, to try to, as I said, expand its reach, provide other decentralized versions of it, so that folks encourage psychiatric survivors to get together with their own groups with as little medication as possible has been my general preference, though some people find it useful, I suppose. But it's a go-to for the pharmaceutical industry and psychiatry because it needs to have a solution so they can put on the white coat and be credible. That's generally my view, and I think, I don't know if Sarah Leonard agrees with me, but that's what I think. So let's not forget that Hiroshima Day is coming up, that in 1945 the U.S. military blew away, 100,000 people, mostly civilians, for essentially a non-military target. And there's kind of some brouhaha about it now because of the movie Oppenheimer, although I think I didn't see the movie, but I've heard a lot of commentary about it, which I suppose I shouldn't use that as the basis, so I won't. Here's a song by David Rovics called Hiroshima. He writes, on August 6, 1945, Hiroshima became the first city to be destroyed by a nuclear weapon. 3 days later, Nagasaki became the second. We now know, as a matter of the public record, what only select political and military leaders knew back then, that the Japanese Empire was attempting to surrender at the time these cities were annihilated and most of their inhabitants, primarily women, children, and the elderly, were killed. We also know that neither city had any military importance, with no factories actually running. All the arguments for the military necessity of dropping nuclear bombs were known by the people making them to be lies. These bombings were war crimes of the highest possible order, crimes of genocide.
Children played in the playground, swinging on swings, didn't hear the sound of the single plane that flew overhead. The third shift workers were just going to bed. There was a flash of light and a rumbling noise, gone in an instant, parents, girls, and boys. 10,000 mothers were boiling rice, 1,000 prisoners of war. They'd survive this terrible storm. When each young man in his uniform vanished in the air in the blink of an eye, one moment they lived, on the next they all died. Farmers at their fields, planning the harvest, guessing at yields, dreaming of life after the war. The next second they aren't living no more.
And, of course, August 6th is Hiroshima Day, the anniversary of the mass murder that happened on that date in 1945. This is going to be a Peace in Ukraine rally in March, starting 11 a.m. at the town clock on that Sunday, which is a week from today, if you're listening to this on the 30th of July. Keith McHenry writes, join us on the anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. It's time to end this conflict between nuclear-armed nations, endorsed by Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz for Bernie, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, UN Association of Santa Cruz, Brave and Free Santa Cruz, and Food Not Bomb, Santa Cruz Music, Free Food, and Speakers. So check it out. 11 a.m. on Sunday, the Sunday after this one.
But in many countries, medication is treated differently than it is in the United States, especially in regard to schizophrenia, and in regard to other diagnoses as well. But in most countries, schizophrenia is seen as a passing condition that will maybe take a year of someone's life, that they'll maybe be on medication for a year or two, and then it'll be over, and they'll move on. In the United States, it's seen as a lifetime condition. Some of the big pharmaceutical companies tend to push those ideas. Some of the organizations, NAMI Santa Cruz is a wonderful organization, but if you look at the national literature, it says things like you will always need to be on
medication. What is NAMI?
NAMI is the National Association for Mental Illness.
Okay.
And it's run, it has a lot of parental involvement, parents of people with mental health diagnoses, and it also has a lot of peer involvement. Locally, it has a lot of great people involved, but their funding nationally who funds their literature is something like 85% pharmaceutical companies, which does have an effect upon what's in those brochures and classes. When I look at the classes, it doesn't fit what I believe in. I would never tell someone you will always be on medication.
That seems like a strange statement. I mean, it seems to me that medication is a decision that should be made between an individual and their medical care providers, their doctor, their their psychiatrist.
And
their
medication can
therapist.
Be wonderful. I've seen medication turn people's lives around with them and do one. I mean, I've seen people who love their medication. Many people are medication compliant and love their medication who come to MHCAN, but not everyone. We're kind of known as the place where we have a lot of people who are off medication. Mm-hmm. I tend to try not to talk a lot about that with personally very much, but when I do, I always have someone coming up to me later blaming me. And I'll just say it right now. I mean, I've been off psychiatric medication since I was 21, and I'm doing great. But quite often, if I've said something like this, and I have before, I'll have someone come up in a year or two and say, I heard you on the meds, and it was a disaster. So I just want to say that's for me, that's my life, and that's not anybody else's life. Many people do beautifully with medication, and I strongly support whatever works for each person.
And is there an official position of the organization, Mental Health Client Action Network, MHCAN? What is that?
The official is that we support what the person wants to do.
Okay.
So we support voluntary, we support the will of the person, the free agency of the individual who's been diagnosed with whatever they've been diagnosed with. We support the person that in their direction of their life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Now, you've talked a little bit about how, and I understand it's for reasons of simplicity, but you've talked about normal versus, like, I guess folks that aren't as normal or whatever. You've talked about normal, quote-unquote, folks coming into MHCAN and how they can sometimes react to someone who has a mental health diagnosis, like, just for example, paranoid schizophrenia, and say, oh, that person's a problem, we need to get rid of them. But is there ever a situation where someone truly is a threat to themselves or others that you've had to deal with in your nearly 11 years now? And how do you handle that? Because there's no way that doesn't come up occasionally, at least, where you've got some type of situation.
What's funny that you would say there's no way that doesn't come up, because I'll tell you what, is that in all of my 10 years, 11 months at MHCAN, the gross physical assaults that we've had have been predominantly from outsiders, literally from outsiders who came in to attack individuals inside, outsiders who are not members. We had a man assault a woman in the parking lot. An elderly woman in her 60s was just shoved over by a stranger that we had never seen before. Another time, a man came in, punched a guy in the head in the main room. He walked in. We had never seen him before. And a third time, a guy came in with a hammer. And he walked through the facility, went upstairs to the office, to the room next to my office, and he hit someone in the head with a hammer.
So these are people that were not members of the organization.
No.
And came in.
No.
What was their motivation? Were they just upset about some particular individual, or were they? I'm concerned that a few bad incidents could turn some folks away.
So we've had.
It sounds like in the many years you've been there, this has happened only a few times, and in every case, it was not a member.
There's been two times that members became violent. Both people were people who had the exact same experience that prompted it, which was that, and this is every diagnosis has a different kind of violence associated with it. You may not know, but the main a diagnosis associated with suicide is bipolar disorder. So someone who has a bipolar disorder, 36% end up committing suicide. So when you're talking about a mental health diagnosis with bipolar, you're looking at suicide. If you're looking at the killing of one's children, you're looking at a man or a woman with depression. You're looking at a man who's a family annihilator who's struggling with depression, or you're looking at a woman with postnatal depression in general. So depression tends to be associated with killing your own children. Bipolar tends to be associated with suicide. And when it comes to attacking random strangers, that's schizophrenia. So twice in all the years that I've been there, we've had individuals with schizophrenia who believed that somebody else was talking to them when it was actually voices that they were hearing. And so they associated these negative, threatening voices with an individual, and they acted out in what they saw was self-defense.
But you're saying that these weren't members who behaved in
this fashion? No, these two times. The first time I described to you people who were not members, we've had like five violent incidents. Three of them were not members. And two of them were.
It sounds like it's pretty rare.
It's very rare. And in fact, if you just have a mental disorder, quote unquote, and not a substance abuse issue, you are less likely to ever become violent with another human being if you purely have a mental health diagnosis than a quote unquote normal person. A normal person is more likely to become violent and assaultive than someone who has a purely mental health disorder.
It just sounds like, it sounds from what you're describing that it's fairly rare at MHCAM that you have an incident of that
it
sort.
It is. It's maybe once every 2 years, or 3 years. Yeah.
In that instance where you had something like that happen, how do you handle it? Do you call in the, what was it, MERT?
No.
Mental health?
No, I'm really...
You just do it, you just...
We just... I'm really good at... De-escalating situations.
Okay.
And my staff is wonderful at de-escalating. We just de-escalate and handle it and move on.
Well, I walked right into a bunch of wonderfully welcoming people,
yeah.
And
yeah.
I it seemed like a really seemed like a really welcoming and calm
it
environment
is.
Filled with artwork. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the companion animals, because you mentioned when I was there, and I did see a few, that folks are welcome to bring their, not just, you know, official service animals, but companion animals to
yeah,
the center.
Absolutely.
And how does that work?
It works really, really well. We have a lot of people bring dogs. Some people bring cats. We've had a companion rabbit.
Oh.
We've had companion rats. We've had companion mice. We've had companion parrots. We've had companion humans.
What is a companion human?
A companion human is someone who maybe someone is has a partner, and they don't like to go anywhere without their partner, and they just don't feel safe when they're not around their partner. And maybe their partner is a quote-unquote normal person, but they themselves have significant mental health diagnoses. Then they're welcome to bring their partner as a human companion animal.
And these companion animals and humans, they're just visiting the center during open hours?
Yes. We have three cats that are feline support workers, and so they work at MHCAN.
Almost like a cat cafe type of situation.
Exactly. And that's Kitty and Jack and Alexander.
Three cats.
Yeah.
Nice. I met two out of the three of them today, and they were extremely affectionate.
Yeah.
They were very sweet.
We also have support fish, but they're a little bit distant.
Yeah. I want to remind listeners, you're listening to Talk of the Bay here at 90.7 KSQD. Unfortunately, no call-ins today. I apologize to the folks. I told earlier today and earlier this week that you could call in. We don't have a call screener today, but hopefully we'll have one next time. My guest today is Sarah Leonard, Executive Director of the Mental Health Client Action Network, or MHCAN. And we only have about 10 minutes left in the show, so Sarah, I want to make sure that we get to anything that you really, really wanted to talk about that I didn't bring up. So I see you have a publication sitting here. That's a possibility. If you want to talk about any of the clients that you feel comfortable without names, of course, just sharing personal stories, just anything that you want to talk about in the last 10 minutes here that would help listeners understand what MHCAN is all about and why
you know, perhaps they should get involved, or if they themselves have a mental health diagnosis or substance use disorder and were seeking services, or they know someone, or just anything at all you want to spend the last 10 minutes on.
Sure. There's a few things. I'd first just like to say that COVID has taken a real toll on the mental health community in the last few years, and that the CDC gave out a warning earlier this year that if you have bipolar or schizophrenia, you're much more likely to die of COVID than other people.
Why is that?
Well, so we could get into the whole, there's something called the ACE study and epigenetics. So there's genetic differences in everyone, and certain epigenetic differences have been tied into trauma, and those differences have also been tied into diagnoses of schizophrenia, bipolar, PTSD, and depression. And those make epigenetic changes, including the length of your telomeres, which predicts basically how long you're going to live. Those kind of vulnerabilities, when you have a disease like COVID, come into play, and people who might ordinarily live a bit longer but still shorter than the average human. People who are diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar usually live about 20, 30 years less than other people.
There's also the component you mentioned to me earlier of some folks not trusting doctors or medical professionals.
That's completely separate from that when you look at the statistics, but it's also true that people who are in the mental health community, like myself, a psychiatric survivor, my experiences in hospitals are of feeling invaded and feeling disrespected. So I don't like to go to the hospital, and in no way am I unique in that regard. Many people are just like me in my community, and so what happens is people put off going to the hospital over and over and over, and then by the time they go, they're in late stage cancer, basically.
Or with COVID, maybe they didn't seek medical help soon enough. Like why are folks?
So people, that's a physical vulnerability. I think that with the late cancer diagnosis that we see in our community being really common, that's a psychological thing. But with COVID, it's a physical epigenetic thing.
Interesting. So COVID created even more of a crisis within the folks in the middle who struggle with mental health diagnoses.
It's for a
variety
of
reasons.
I mean, a lot of people have died. We have at MHCAN, we've lost 78 people in the last 3 years. My two best friends in the whole world both died this last year, but they died of fentanyl.
Mm.
So that's another thing that I'd like to mention, is that Santa Cruz has been in the middle of a meth crisis for years, and it is now in the middle of a fentanyl and xylazine crisis that's very real, and people are dying everywhere.
I think COVID just created a mental health crisis kind of generally across the board. The numbers of folks struggling with depression, anxiety, sleep disorders, all kinds of addiction, et cetera, those increased during COVID, partly because of isolation, partly because of the uncertainty, partly because of the loss of routine and other things, folks in your family getting sick or even dying. So COVID in general, just it took a real toll, I think, on mental health. And of course, it makes sense that it would take a toll on a community of folks that's already, you know, has these diagnoses.
But I think what I wanted to say is just that a lot of people are kind of acting like the pandemic is over, COVID is over. But that people in your life, if you have a loved one who has autism, schizophrenia, bipolar, PTSD, or bipolar or major depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, autism, PTSD, those five things have been identified as having much higher death rates. So please, please, please take care of your relatives and your loved ones by being careful, and by still being careful, because it's still out here.
COVID.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the last couple of minutes that we have, maybe you could tell people how to access your services at MHCAN, how people who maybe don't have a mental health diagnosis or don't have a substance abuse issue could help a family member to access MHCAN, and like just basically what kinds of things can people do to extend their lifespan or help their family member extend their lifespan or have a better quality of life if they are, you know, struggling and need services.
So people, again, can just walk in. We've been having, all through July, we'll continue having Costco pizza every Thursday at noon if people are feeling hungry. If you also like Scrabble and you want to play Scrabble with me, I will play Scrabble with anyone who challenges me to a game. You can also and be asked to be given a tour of the place, and we can show you around and you can see if you feel comfortable there or not. I mean, it's not for everyone, but it is for a lot of people. And it's a lovely community. It's a lovely, loving community.
It did seem very loving. Everyone I met was so welcoming. So one more time, your website, your address.
www.mhcan.org, and our address is 1051 Cayuga. And I forgot to mention, we also do, we have a shower program, and we also do laundry. You can get free laundry done if you're in financial distress in our community. And you can also come and get showers. We also have a donation statement where you can get clothing and things that you need.
And you mentioned transportation services, doctor's appointments, and to the zoo in San Francisco and other trips. Anyway, thank you so much, Sarah Leonard, for joining me today. I really appreciate you joining me on Talk of the Bay today.
Thank you.
And here's a Rovick song I hope we haven't played before. It's called The Dam, and what he writes about it as a sort of an additional informational bit is what is known in Iceland as the only act of domestic terrorism committed in the country's history occurred on August 25, 1970, in the Laxá Valley. It involved a midnight dynamiting of a dam. Over 100 farmers came to participate in the action, all of whom called into the police the next day to declare their responsibility for it. They blew up the dam to protest the government's plans to build a much bigger dam. The dam was never built. The authorities were never able to ascertain which farmers actually blew up the dam, and no one was ever punished for this crime, which is sometimes known in Iceland as the event that gave birth to the modern environmental movement there.
Beside a volcano and the rising ash, a crystal river rushing past, a crystal river flowing free, now again like it used to be. Since now the dam is out of sight, blown apart by dynamite, blown apart by everyone in the land of the midnight sun. 100 farmers the next day called the cops so they could say, if you're looking for one to blame, 100 farmers gave their names, said it was I who couldn't just stand idly by. We all knew that sometimes you must commit a crime. There was a blast, a booming sound, and the dam came crashing down. Voices shrill said the dam should be bigger still. By the Laxá Riverside, 100 farms would be washed aside. Legal efforts and protests failed, but they still had air behind their sails. They had air and dynamite, so they gathered round late one night. There was a blast, a booming sound, and the dam came crashing down. Prosecutors tried to choose which farmers had lit the fuse, but not a one would tell the tale, and not one farmer went to jail. The dam was never built again, but many still remember when by the Laxá River they set things right with a couple sticks of dynamite. There was a blast, a booming sound, and the dam came crashing down. There was a blast, a booming sound, and the dam came crashing down. Crashing down.
today is the 25th of July. I think we're 25th. And I'm talking with Cooper DeAngelo, and it's about 9 o'clock in the morning. I just gave you a call, Cooper, to see what has been happening, because you predicted yesterday that, well, you predicted nothing would happen, but you also were wondering what would happen, and I was wondering, too, because police threatened to return and evict the community of 30 people that are living up at the end of, what is it, Golf Club Road or whatever it's called?
Right. It's up in the Poconos, so it's past, yeah.
Yeah. So so you say instead the police came and delivered two porta-potties, but of unknown purpose, huh?
Right. What I saw this morning, a lot of people have packed their things and stashed them in the bushes to avoid being robbed by police.
Mm-hmm.
So that, at the same time, I noticed a truck coming up the road, pulling two porta-potties on the flatbed, and they dropped it off a little up the road from us, at the entrance of the other camp area, and then one of the police, I guess he parked over by the porta potty but didn't talk to anybody, and then he left, and then now a police on a four-wheel motorcycle quad came up. So we're not sure if the porta potties were delivered for us.
Or against you, yeah.
Right, because or if it's workmen that they're doing it for. So we're just hanging tight. We haven't packed anything because this is the best place that we can be right now, and the rest of the people too. So
you say
we're just hanging tight.
There's another community nearby, you say.
Well, the way that it's arranged, there are these meadows. Area. So we're on a lower, kind of a lower meadow area. And then just up the trail a little, there's another kind of open meadow area in the trees that probably another 20 people are up there.
Uh-huh. Now, how many people of your group do you think have packed up their stuff and prepared to... because I'm afraid you can't really hide your stuff from police if they're going to really clear the area, because they'll come in and...
Well, yeah, because we're in the woods. So there's bushes everywhere.
I see.
So people go and hide in the bushes from police crime.
Huh.
Isn't that sad that the residents have to pack their stuff and hide their stuff from being robbed by police?
Particularly sad
and
for...
The police don't even live here. They're residents coming in.
Yeah, sad for people who are experiencing it like yourself.
Garbage truck coming up.
And have you...
Wow.
What do you see?
Santa Cruz may be... We may have the world news come up here, and now they're all of a sudden going to start to make it look good. Porta-potties and garbage pickup, all the things that should have been before that they neglected to do.
Well, now, what are you seeing? Are you seeing news media vans? Are you seeing garbage vans? What are you seeing?
Not the news yet, but I do anticipate that that's probably the reason that they're trying to clean up their act here. Not our crew, but the city. Because the city shut down garbage and even wouldn't do a contract with our friend Brad, who does the garbage pickup. And he has many stories of how he's tried to, facilitate garbage pickup for us, and the city blocks him.
Now, is this back at the Benchlands or at the Highway 9?
I talked to him just a week ago.
Ah, okay. You mean in your new location?
Yeah.
So is this police officer that you recently saw still present?
The police car that drove in went up to the higher meadow, and it was reported that he just parked by the porta potties, and then we saw him drive out. So I don't know if he was just verifying that the porta potties made it to their destination.
Mm-hmm. Are you far away? How far are you from the porta potties?
Probably 150 yards.
And I mean, because I'm wondering, are they open? Are they usable? Or are they locked?
We don't know yet. Somebody's going to go check. And it's good that they've got the garbage truck up here so that we can get rid of some of this garbage, because people have been doing the right thing by bagging up their trash. But again, the garbage man, our friend Brad, who is a good guy, has been blocked by the city from being able to come up here and take the trash as he would like to.
So this is another garbage disposal service, huh?
It looked like a regular big white garbage truck, but it might be Brad. So he's a good guy, and I hope so. Oh, no, they said it's not Brad. It's just a regular city garbage truck.
So how many...
So I don't know if they're planning on doing that to throw
You're beginning to faint out a little bit. Say that again. Again, you're in a bad spot for transmission, it looks like.
Anyway, I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Well, look, that's useful information, and I'm adding it, you know, to the endless record, and we will be playing it on Thursday. But that didn't happen because we're having, well, technical problems with our server. Same thing that is happening the day before this show is being aired on Sunday the 30th. But hopefully you'll be able to hear it if you're listening to it at its usual time, 9:30 and then on into the afternoon, starting in the morning at 9:30. But if you can't, hopefully you'll be tuning in at a later time when the archives are actually up for all you loyal listeners, if any of you are still out there, and I hope you are. Anyway, here's another clip from a fellow who's actually approached me on the street and wanted to simply tell his story. He didn't want to say who he was, though he told me his name off record.